My senior year in college, Jim was one of my roommates. I was working at this church over near Sac State, and that spring they decided as a church they're going to do a pictorial directory. So everybody in the church got their picture taken, and then everybody was given a free 8x10 picture. So here I am, I'm working in this church, and I got a picture. What am I going to do with an 8x10 picture of me? You know? So I brought it back to the apartment, and I stuck it on the ceiling above one of my roommate's beds. The next morning, I asked Fred, I go, Fred, did you dream about me last night? And Fred, no, I didn't. I go, come on. When you were falling asleep last night, you didn't think about me just a little bit? No. Well, my cheesy mug stared down at poor Fred for a couple of days before he realized there was a picture of me there. From that point on, the picture you saw in the announcements started showing up all over the place. You go into the bathroom, you lift up the toilet lid. We'd slip it into somebody's binder and they'd get into the class that day at Sac State and open up. Well, we graduated at the end of May and Jim and Wendy got married that June. And Jim and Wendy asked if Jen and I would drive them to their hotel after the reception. Gladly. We got to the hotel and they were going on a cruise the next day. And so they had their cruise luggage and then they had their overnight luggage. And I looked at Jim and I was just such a good friend. And I said, hey, Jim, why don't you guys go check in? I'll grab the luggage. Well, when they got on their honeymoon and opened up their luggage, 6 months later, Jen and I got married. You want to know what we got for a wedding present? I had Jim and Wendy come and speak at a retreat years later and slipped it into their stuff. It's been going back and forth for years. And so two and a half years ago when I moved down here, I was over at Jim's house. I grabbed one of his boys. And in Jim's den, in his office, he's got pictures all over the place. And I grabbed one of his sons. I said, hey, you guys, slip my picture into one of those. See how long it stays there. And then we had the announcements this morning. I looked at Jim and I said, VBS is coming. He's helping out with VBS. So we'll see what happens. We are in the middle of our Lenten series called Conversations with Jesus. And each Sunday we're looking at a different conversation between Jesus and an individual or a group of individuals. This morning we're looking at one of my favorite conversations. And before we dive into the conversation, there was a line in the movie Braveheart where William Wallace said this, every man dies, not every man really lives. Every man dies, not every man really lives. Saint Irenaeus put it a different way. He said, the glory of God is the man fully alive. The glory of God is the individual that is fully alive, not simply making it through life. There was a youth worker that came up to Howard Hendricks, and Howard Hendricks asked the youth worker, said, how you doing? And the youth worker looked at him and said, oh, pretty good under the circumstances. Howard Hendricks looked at him and said, what are you doing under there? Too often, that's how we live our life, just kind of making it through, just another day. The glory of God is not just making it through. The glory of God is the individual fully alive. And the conversation we're going to look at this morning deals with what it looks like to be fully alive. And we're going to be in the 14th chapter. Oh, we got to go back to the beginning there. We're going to go, you know, if you can read backwards, you're going to get to the entire sermon really quick. There we go. We're going to be in the 14th chapter of Matthew. I'd encourage you to grab a Bible. There's one in the chair underneath you or right in front of you. I'm also going to have all the verses up on the screen if that's helpful. We're just going to be going through this conversation between Jesus and the disciples, most specifically Peter. and find out what it looks like to be fully alive. And so it starts out this way in verse 22 of chapter 14 of Matthew. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. A couple things, just kind of unpack what's going on here. It says that he made the disciples get into the boat and go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. If you're interested, the Sea of Galilee is a little smaller than Lake Tahoe. We always think it's huge. A little smaller than Lake Tahoe. He made them get in a boat to go to the other side of the lake while he dismissed the crowd. If you go back to the previous section in chapter 14 of Matthew, it talks about what crowd he's referring to, and the crowd is the 5,000 that he just fed with a happy meal. All right? And so he looks at the disciples and goes, hey, you guys get in the boat, go to the other side, I'm going to take care of the 5,000 people. After he had dismissed them, I'm assuming the crowd, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone. And the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Two things you need to notice here in these two verses. It says that Jesus got up and went and had time alone. What's your time alone with Jesus looking like during Lent? The season of Lent, we're smack dab in the middle of the season of Lent. It's 40 days leading us to the cross, to the crucifixion, and ultimately the resurrection. And during those 40 days, it's a time set aside for people to reflect, to fast, to pray, to repent, to be with God in profound ways. Oftentimes during Lent, people do different spiritual disciplines to make them increasingly aware of the reality of Jesus. And so my question for you is this. How's your time of Lent been? How has this season drawn you closer to Jesus? How during the last 20 some odd days have you been made more aware of your sin, of the relentless tenderness of Jesus? What has your Lent look like? And I seriously want to know. And so I'm going to ask you, tell me what has been the highlight of Lent for you thus far. Maybe it's been the reading that we've been doing. Maybe there's been another practice that you have been developing during the season. Let me know. Call me, text me, email me. If you want, you can grab that little card in the seat back, put your name on it, and on the back just write how during Lent you're more aware of Jesus. Because my hope would be that we're more intentional during these 40 days than maybe during the previous 40 days. So what's Lent look like for you? Or is this one of those shoelace moments? I really like to know. Jesus spent time alone. Do we do the same? The next thing I want you to pay attention to is there's water in this story. And you might think, well, duh. They're on a lake. There's water. What's the big deal with water? Water is tremendously significant in the scriptures. Deep water in the ancient Near East was a symbol for chaos. Water, when you discuss water, especially deep water, people in the ancient Near East would go, oh yeah, that is the very picture of chaos. That is the picture of out of control. That is a picture of scary, we don't get it, chaos. Which is why as you go through the Bible, you see significant portions dealing with water. And in all those cases, it's dealing with the reality of chaos. Look at how the Bible starts. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the Spirit of the Lord hovered over the... It's a picture of chaos. The picture is the Creator God is hovering over that which was out of control, that which was chaos, and in that place, God took what was chaotic and brought it to Tov, to something that was good, beautiful, functional. The other word you'll find around there is the idea of shalom. We always say peace, but I think peace is bigger than we think because peace is more than just absence of chaos. It is wholeness. It is fullness. Out of the chaos, God creates shalom, that which is tov, which is good. You get Moses and the Red Sea. Again, big water. And it's out of the chaos that God delivers his people to a land of promise. You get Jonah and the water. You get Jesus sleeping in the boat over chaos. It's chaotic. Things are out of control. And yet God does something there as he restores order, brings beauty and function back. And so when you see that there's water here, it's significant. There's chaos. I don't know if you're like me, but we tend to go from moments of chaos into places of shalom, then back into chaos, and then back into shalom. The disciples have just witnessed the feeding of the 5,000. Whew! Things are amazing! And after the time of amazing, what happens? Chaos. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." Too often, we look at this story and we think the disciples, "Oh, you silly disciples. You should have known that that was Jesus. Oh, disciples." I'm with the disciples here. It makes sense that they are terrified. Think about it. It's dark. They're out on the water, and there's suddenly something walking on the water. Some of these guys are fishermen. They spent their whole life on the lake, and never once have they seen someone walking on the lake. There wasn't a part in their brain that said, "Oh, my default position is something on the water, must be someone walking." It makes complete sense that they're terrified. This is the first of two times we have to address the issue of fear in this conversation, and this first fear I like to call floating head fear. And some of you have heard me tell this story before. When I was growing up, the house I grew up in had a long hallway that was shaped like an L. And so you'd go from like the living room over here, and you'd walk down the hall, and then you'd turn. This is the short part of the L. My bedroom's right here at the corner of the L. My door opened up and faced the bottom part of the L. And it faced my parents' door. So at the other end of the bottom of the L is my parents' door. So if both doors were open, my parents' room and my room, you could look into one another's room. One particular night, I was getting ready to leave my room. I opened up the door. I turned off my light. The light in the hallway was on. My parents' door was open, but the light in their room was off. So I open up my door, I turn off the light, I look into my parents' room, and in the back corner of my parents' room is a woman's head floating in midair. I did not go check what the floating head was, because I'd seen the movies. And you never go by yourself to check those things out because those people never come back. I went to the hallway. I went down the hallway to my dad. My dad was sitting in the living room reading the paper. I looked at him. My dad looks at me. And he goes, "What's wrong, Mike?" He could tell. Now, I had to think about what I was going to tell to my dad in this moment. Didn't want to sound too crazy. And so I came up with the best thing to say. I just looked at my dad and I said, "There's a woman's head floating in your room." Now, to my dad's credit, he did not laugh at me as all of you so callously did. He knew that his son had seen something. I don't think he believed there was a woman's head floating in his room. But so he put his paper down, he gets up, and he starts walking down the hall. I walked with them because, again, in the horror movies, the people that split up die. And I'm staying with my dad. Dad's walking, I'm walking. My dad walks down the hall, gets to the turn, turns, and stops. He saw what I saw. My dad just kind of looked into his bedroom and then slowly walked towards the room. He didn't walk into his room. He reached into his room. My dad's no dummy. Flipped on the light, and there in the back corner of his room was a hanging plant my mother had put there that was, in the dark, the perfect silhouette of Medusa's head. I learned a couple things that night. First, light exposes fear for what it is. And I'm way more brave when I'm with my dad. There's this moment, these guys are in a boat, it's dark, and there's a floating head. And they're terrified. They don't understand what it is. And they're gonna remain terrified until something happens. And what happens is this. In the Gospel of Mark, this same event is recorded, but in Mark, there's another line that we don't see in Matthew. And the line is this: he was about to pass by, which is an odd line. Because I remember years ago reading this going, what gives with Jesus about to pass by? It sounds like Jesus is on, you know, it's on the shore, and he tells the disciples, okay, boys, we're going to have a race across the lake. You guys get a boat, and you guys get a head start, ready, set, go. And they start out and, you know, row, row, row your boat. And after a while, Jesus goes, well, I think I've given them enough time. Go. And Jesus starts walking across the lake. And that's what it sounds like when I read it in Mark. He's about ready to pass by. It's like, I'm taking the lead. That's what it sounds like, but it's not what's happening. When it says he's about to pass by, the Greek word there is erchomai, and it means to pass by, but it's not talking about taking the lead. It's a theophany. It's a big word. It's God is about to reveal himself in a powerful way. It's the same imagery you get with Moses when the glory of God passes by Moses. You remember that story? It's an erchomai moment. Or imagine when Elijah is in the mountain and the glory of God comes and passes by. This is what's happening here. The disciples are in this chaotic place. They are afraid. Things are in chaos. And all of a sudden, the glory and power of God is going to show up. And he says, it's I, don't be afraid. He goes, I know you guys are afraid. I know things seem completely out of control right now. But I'm about to show you something. I'm about ready to do something that's going to help you get a grip on what's going on. Peter replies, Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water. I love me some Peter. There's a lot of debate about what Peter's actually asking here. Some people will argue that Peter's going, hey, Jesus is about ready to do another miracle. He just did the feeding of the 5,000. Now apparently he's walking on water. I want in. I mean, I got to help out with the feeding of the 5,000 thing. I was in charge of the McNuggets. And now he's walking on water. It's like, wow, he did this. Now he's doing this. I want to be part of this. Some people argue that's what's going on. Other people think that, hey, it's just Peter being impetuous again. If you know Peter, you know that he is a leap before look kind of guy. He's the guy that when Jesus was telling all the disciples, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be tortured, I'm going to be crucified. Peter's response, no, no you're not. Or imagine, you know, think back to the time in the Garden of Gethsemane, they come to arrest Jesus. What does Peter do? Pulls out a sword, lops off a guy's ear. This is Peter. You know, the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter's response, hey, maybe we should have a barbecue. You know, this is Peter. And so some people look at this and go, hey, it's just Peter being Peter again. Oh, Jesus is there? Other people, and I tend to be in this third camp, think it's actually a moment of restraint by an impetuous guy. He sees Jesus as best he can. He recognizes the voice as best he can in the midst of the wind and the waves. And he goes, oh, I really want to be where he is. I really want to be a part of what Jesus is doing, but I'm not going to jump until I know something. He goes, Jesus, if that's you, could you help me here? I need a little more clarity. Jesus said, come. Then Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. Peter says, hey, Lord, 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 if that's you, just tell me. Jesus' response, one word. Come. Come. Come to where I am. Come, come, join me in what I'm doing. Come. Do we dare believe that Jesus says the same word to us that he said to Peter? Come. I want you to be part of what I'm doing. Come. I want you to be where I am. Come. Well, Peter got out of the boat and he started walking on the water. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink, cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You of little faith, he said, why did you doubt? Okay, so is this a story of great faith or is it a story of an epic failure? Well, on the one hand, Peter got out of the boat. Peter sunk. So which is it? Great faith? Epic failure? Maybe it's both. Peter walked on water. Peter took more steps on the water than the other 11 disciples combined. Peter took more steps on the water than anyone else in human history that I know. Peter walked on water, and Peter was a fisherman. Peter was familiar with boats. He was comfortable in boats. But being comfortable wasn't Peter's primary agenda. It was being with Jesus. Being where Jesus was, doing what Jesus did. That was more important to Peter than simply being comfortable. Meanwhile, the other 11 disciples remain in a boat. They remain, as John Ortberg calls them in his book, If You Want to Walk on Water, You Got to Get Out of the Boat. A good book, by the way. He calls those people boat potatoes. We're familiar with couch potatoes? These guys were boat potatoes. Oh, Peter wasn't a boat potato. Peter was a water walker. He got out of the boat and walked toward Jesus. A tremendous act of faith. But then he began to sink. This moment of great faith turns into this moment of, well, shame, I suppose. It says that he cried out. He became afraid. He saw the wind, the waves. He became afraid. This is the second time we see fear in this story. The first time is the floating head fear. There's something I can't explain. This is a different kind of fear. This is what I will call losing what you got kind of fear. And you might be thinking, Mike, that's improper English. Yes, it is, but it's a quote taken from the movie Rocky III, so that makes sense. In the movie Rocky III, Rocky has already been savagely knocked out by Clubber Lang, and he's training for the rematch, and he's really struggling. And there comes a point where he gets into a conversation with his wife, Adrian, of Yo Adrian fame. And this is what Rocky says. You want to know the truth? The truth is, I don't want to lose what I've got. In the beginning, I didn't care about what happened to me. I'd go in the ring. I'd get busted up. I didn't care. But now there's you. There's the kid. I don't want to lose what I got. I'm afraid, all right? You want to hear me say it? You want to break me down? All right. I'm afraid. For the first time in my life, I'm afraid. Afraid of losing what you got. Afraid of letting go and being a little bit out of control. I'm afraid of losing what I got. I like it more when I'm the one in control. I like the boat. I know the boat. I feel like I have some control in the boat. I don't want to lose what I got. I do not want to lose what I got. I love this line from a David Crowder song that says, like a match being lit or the sinking of a ship, letting go gives a better grip. Sometimes holding on's a bad idea. It's a whole lot better to let go. Until we realize that being with Jesus and being a part of what he's doing requires us to let go and give up control, we're always going to be in a place of perpetual fear. You got to be able to let go. There's this thinking, and it's completely backwards. And the thinking goes like this. Shalom, peace, wholeness, is in the places that we control. In the places that we're very familiar. That's the place of shalom in the boat. The place of risk, oh, that's chaos. This is what we usually think. Oh, shalom, whole, peace. In the places I control, in the places I'm familiar, it's safe there. The places of risk, that's chaos. Thing is, it's usually the other way around. The shalom, the wholeness, living a life that is fully alive, is in the places of risk. Chaos is in the boat. You'll notice that the only place where there wasn't fear was when he was out on the water initially with Jesus. When they were in the boat, they were in chaos. We like to think that the place of safety is the place of peace, and it's just the other way around. And then Peter cries out, Lord, save me. I love this. Lord, save me. I failed again. But he recognizes two things. One, he's Lord. He's the one, the Erkomai, the God showing up, revealing something. He is the light of the world, revealing fear for what it is. We're a little more brave when we're with our Father. He's realizing all of that right now. It's like, oh my goodness, you're Lord and you're the only one that can save me. And he cries out. When they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshiped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret. If you've been doing the Lent readings, there's an invitation in the reading to find yourself in the conversation. Find yourself in the text. So where do you see yourself in this story? Maybe you see yourself walking with Peter. Maybe you find yourself sinking with Peter. Or maybe you're a boat potato. You go, that's kind of where I am. I'm not going to risk anything. There was a poem that was in John Ortberg's book, if you want to walk on water, you got to get out of the boat. There was a poem that, as I was reading it, well, you'll see. He writes the following. To sinful patterns of behavior that never get confronted and changed, abilities and gifts that never get cultivated and deployed, until weeks become months and months turn into years. And one day you're looking back on a life of deep, intimate, gut-wrenchingly honest conversations you never had. Great, bold prayers you never prayed. Exhilarating risks you never took. Sacrificial gifts you never offered. Lives you never touched. And sitting in a recliner with a shriveled soul and forgotten dreams, and you realize there's a world of desperate need and a great God calling you to be part of something bigger than yourself. You see the person you could have become, but did not. You never followed your calling. You never got out of the boat. You never got out of the boat. N.T. Wright, in describing Peter in this passage, described him this way: caught between glory and terror. That's Peter. He's caught between glory, walking on water with Jesus, and terror. I'm completely out of control. And I was thinking about this, caught between glory and terror, and I realized that's me. I find myself caught between glory and terror. On my best day, it's like I'm with Jesus, and I'm risking, and I'm following, and then I go, but I don't want to lose control. I'm unwilling to fully surrender, but I want to be with Jesus. And caught between glory and terror. Chances are that's where you are this morning. We long to walk on water, to trust Jesus completely with all that we have and all that we are, but the wind and waves, the giving up of control and total surrender, and we revert back to being spurred by fear instead of by the relentless tenderness of Jesus. But I want to walk on water. I want the courage to step out of the boat, step out of that place of control and fear, and to repent of sinful patterns, to cultivate and deploy my gifts, to pray bold prayers, take exhilarating risks, offer sacrificial gifts, touch lives, dream dreams of being part of something bigger than myself. And when I fail, and I will fail and fail, in that moment of failure and shame, to have the courage and wisdom to cry out, Lord, my Savior, rescue me, and may I have the humility to receive his correction, his rebuke, so that I might walk better, so I might walk a straighter path. I had a basketball coach in college that would say, don't get upset and worried when I yell at you. Get worried when I stop yelling. I'm yelling because I see something in you. I want you to be a better ball player. When I stop yelling, it means I've given up on you. Oh, I want to hear the rebuke. I want to hear the rebuke of Jesus call out to me. And may I have the humility and wisdom to receive it so I can walk better. I was in a conversation with someone recently, and we were talking about, okay, what does it look like to actually step out of the boat? If Jesus is saying, come, and he wants us to come and be a part of what he is doing, how do I know what I'm supposed to do? When am I supposed to leave the boat? And maybe the answer is this: see what Jesus is doing, join in. See what Jesus is doing, join in. Sounds a little risky. That's the point. See what Jesus is doing, do that. And see what happens. Here at Community Covenant Church, we have three words that help describe what we're all about: connecting, growing, serving, connecting with God and with other people, growing closer to God as we go closer to one another, and serving Christ by serving one another. If you're looking for what God is doing, there are some things you can do very easily. Think of our connecting, growing, serving. There are ways to do that. We're giving you opportunities to step out of the boat. Serving. Three of the primary ways that we serve at this church are Mexicali, Parker Whitney Elementary School, gathering in. These are three of the primary ways that we seek to serve Jesus by serving other people. And guess what? All three of those are happening this week. Today, there is a training for our Mexicali team. They're going to be preparing to serve well. There is a board right outside these doors that has envelopes on it. If you look at, hey, how do I become part of that team? There's a board out there. Each on the board, there are a bunch of envelopes. Every envelope has a number. The number goes with the amount of money you give. So if there's an envelope that says 14, you give $14. Put the $14 in there. You take a prayer card and you start praying for them. But maybe as you walk out, I don't know how many of you have actually picked up your envelope. I know there's still some out there. But as you walk out, they go, oh, 14. That seems comfortable. Oh, jump. Jump. Risk a little bit. See what happens. Then tomorrow, Parker Whitney Elementary School. We say we exist here to bless that school. And everyone that calls himself part of this church should be able to say at the end of every school year, this is how I blessed Parker Whitney Elementary. It's easy tomorrow. Their choir's coming here. They love us so much. They go, we would love to come and sing at your church. People are always, how do we get into the schools? The school's coming to us. 3 o'clock tomorrow, if your schedule allows it, be here. We're going to fill that whole space out. In fact, after the service today, you're going to be all out there talking and eating. And there's going to come a moment when Justin's going to go, time to set up. Many hands make light work. We're going to transform that room out there to a place the choir can come. Hey, if you're looking for a way to serve, move a chair and come clap for kids. And then on Wednesday, one of the other ways that we consistently want to serve is with the gathering in. It's a Western theme this time. I don't have any cowboy boots, but I got a hat. I'm ready to do some line dancing. If you've worked with the gathering in before, you know what an amazing, risky place that is. And you're going to come back, I hope. If you've never done the gathering in with us, it might be one place to go, how do I know where to jump out of the boat? That might be it. If you have any questions, Susie's right back there. She's going to do this. There she is. You can talk to her after the service. Get signed up to help out. It might be a way for you to see what Jesus is doing and join in. Growing. We put together the Lent reading schedule to give you an opportunity to go deeper in your conversation with Jesus. Some of you I know started doing it and go, you know what? The way that it's set up is not comfortable for me. And so you went back to reading your old way. If you haven't done the reading, it's not too late. Pick one up at the Welcome Center. Read for the rest of Lent. We say we're all about growing closer to Jesus and closer in relationship with other people. If you're not in a small group, that's one of the primary ways we do that. And if you want to be part of a small group, Justin's right there. Grab him after the service and go, I want to be part of a small group. Or maybe the place you need to step is you've been in a small group for a long time. Maybe God's calling you to leave the comfort of your small group boat and start a new small group. Oh, no. I'm comfortable with my small group. Congratulations, you potato. When it comes to connecting, our primary way of connecting is right here on a Sunday morning. But during Holy Week, the week that leads up to Easter, we're providing three unique opportunities designed for you to connect with God in profound ways. We're going to be offering an opportunity to walk the Stations of the Cross early in the week. There's a Monday-Thursday service on Thursday. There's a Good Friday service on Friday. If you've never participated in those, maybe it's time to step out. You might just meet God in a way you weren't prepared for. Throughout the season of Lent, I have been reading the Lent readings, But then I've also been reading the Psalms, and I've just been so intrigued by how often the Psalms are fitting with what we're talking about on a Sunday morning. I was reading in Psalm 16, and it said this: "In my distress, I called to the Lord. I cried to my God for help. From his temple, he heard my voice. My cry came before him into his ears. He parted the heavens and came down. Dark clouds were under his feet. He reached down from on high and took hold of me. He drew me out of the deep waters." Then I was reading in Psalm 23. And I was amazed at what Psalm 23 was saying in light of Peter walking on water. And when I was done reading, this is what I wrote in my journal. I said, there was a moment, not entirely sure how long the moment lasted, where Peter was walking on the water. In that moment, he was not afraid. The waters were quiet for him. His focus was on Christ, and the peace he was experiencing flowed from the reality that he was with Jesus. "He leads me beside quiet waters. I will fear no evil, for you are with me." And I simply said, "Abba, may my gaze rest on you longer today." And then on Friday, I wrote this in my journal. Jesus simply said, "Come. Come to where I am. Join me in what I am doing." Do I dare believe Jesus says the same word to me that he said to Peter? Come. I have no reason to believe he would say anything else. Would you pray with me?